Ørsted is proposing to develop the Isle of Man's first offshore wind farm, and as we heard on Perspective 3 weeks ago, not everyone is happy about the proposal. I caught up with Ørsted last week to get their thoughts on the development.
You have a development off the northeast of the Isle of Man, which you are hoping to proceed with. We heard a few weeks ago from some of the people who are going to be most affected by this, and it's fair to say that they are deeply worried about your proposal. What would you say to them?
I think firstly I'd want to acknowledge that it's absolutely understandable and right and fair that people are raising concerns. I wouldn't dismiss their concerns at all. You know, we have built a lot of wind farms around the UK. We know that this can be a challenging kind of a concept to get your head around, and there are perfectly valid reasons why people are expressing those concerns. I think what I would say is please come and engage. We've had consultations and engagement with communities around the island in the last few years, but there's still the opportunity through the examination process to raise those concerns and for them to be discussed and understood by the examiners as they consider the project.
The objectors did say that they didn't feel as though there has been enough opportunity for them to engage. Again, you know, how would you respond to that?
I'm sorry people feel that they haven't had the chance. I'll let Jamie expand a little bit on what we've done in terms of consultation. We've tried really hard, and you know, I accept the criticism. Some people may feel that's not been enough, but we have worked really hard to make sure that we're talking to communities right around the island, obviously particularly focusing on those who will have sight of it. But everyone needs to be involved in that. We have tried our very best to make sure people have had an opportunity to come and talk to us, express their concerns here, and learn more about how the project will look, how it will operate. And as I say, I would hope that people who still wish to bring up points will do so through the examination process. That's absolutely there for them to use.
Jamie, then, you've sure. been name-dropped here, so it's all your fault.
Oh, yeah, apparently so. So we've been developing these proposals since 2022. Obviously, the history goes back a bit further than that, but we've been active in the community on the island really since late 22. As part of that process, we did carry out in 2024 a full public engagement consultation, which included drop-in sessions across a week, in particularly focused around the northeast coast. And we did have quite a few people, local people, come to those and express both positive and negative views about the proposals, but also raising concerns and things that they wanted considering, which we took on and have helped us develop those plans as they've moved forward. So we've had a good amount of engagement through that process. It's part of the process. In addition to that, obviously, once we've submitted the application, the government has held its own public consultation, which ran from September through till November last year. And in addition to that, we've had dozens of stakeholder meetings with key statutory and non-statutory organisations and groups on the islands. For instance, we met with Marinda and Richard and the GARF commissioners at the beginning of February. We'd been in touch with them through the engagement process as well, through coming to the stakeholder events. So we've reached out and we've tried to go and provide facts and context to our proposals. Obviously, we're not expecting people necessarily to agree with what we've put forward, and that's part of the discussion and debate that we're seeing at the examination process. But I do think we have engaged quite widely up to date. Obviously, people don't always, they might be away, they might be off island, and that's difficult, obviously, to plan to catch absolutely everybody. There is a requirement, I guess, for people to be interested in it. So I do recognise that perhaps back in 24 there wasn't as much interest in the proposals. There clearly is now, and we continue to work with stakeholders as we go through the process. Now we're in a more formal process, that is through the examination forum, which is a six-month, independent, open, evidence-based process where members of the public, as well as organisations with an interest in the proposals are invited and encouraged to air those concerns, to write, ask questions of the examiners, ask questions of us, and to provide kind of evidence to support their views on our proposals.
And again, we heard in the programme with the GAF commissioners and the two other objectors that they felt bullied by Ørsted. Mm. Is that something you recognise?
I do think that's a little unfair, and obviously we provided a statement around that. I think, to be fair to Marinda, who I did listen to the Perspective programme a few weeks ago, it was more bullying tactics, and I think that came from her kind of view that in the hearing sessions there were quite a few of the Ørsted team there, and the reason we were there was because essentially we're the ones being examined, rightly so, and we need people who know all aspects of a project. This is a big project. We don't just have one single person who knows everything. It's a team. So we had a number of people who were present at that hearing so we could answer as fully as possible the questions that both the stakeholders and the examiners had. And I think the reflection was that on the other side of the table, as it were, there were maybe just one or two people representing other organisations, such as, for instance, we had the Steam Packet, for instance. We did have quite a few number of people as well from DEFRA and the DOI. So from listening to the programme, I think it was more that didn't sit right. But that is the process. I would refute very strongly that we've come across as bullying. I don't actually think that was the intention. And I have, you know, we have reached out with that statement to say we are very aware this is a big change potentially for the island. It needs to benefit everyone on the island. I think it's really important to say these proposals have come about because we were invited by the government at the time to submit a tender. We haven't just turned up as kind of salesmen selling snake oil. We were invited to put in a proposal. We were lucky enough to win that tender, and that is what we're basing this proposals on. I do think it's to accuse us of bullying is wrong, but I do also accept, I'm not sure that was the exact intention. It was more that it felt uncomfortable that there was quite a few of us trying to answer the questions, and maybe that felt a bit overwhelming. That was my take.
And you can sort of understand that, can't you? Individuals up against a large multinational company, inevitably they're not going to have the same resource to be able to develop their case and present that case as Ørsted does. I mean, I presume this is the sort of reaction you get wherever you go to try and develop a wind farm.
Yeah, I think if I was on the island, I'd like to see a company put in those resources to show that we know what we're doing. We have done this numerous times before. We take it seriously, and we've got the people who can answer the questions that are rightly asked of us. So if we turned up with just me trying to answer everything, I would probably get criticised for not knowing the details. So that's what we're trying to do here, is we're trying to justify our proposals and explain our assessments that have been carried out. And for that, we do need a number of people to do that. For me, it's a sign that Ørsted know what they're doing. We should have some confidence. They've done this numerous times before. We are the leading offshore developer in the world. I do accept that there probably is inevitably with any of these large infrastructure projects, whether ourselves or other companies or other technologies, there is a feeling that the kind of David and Goliath feeling there. What I've been really clear, and one of the reasons we went to meet GAF commissioners in February, was to reach out and to say, look, we want to work. We understand you're not going to necessarily agree with what we're putting forward, but we want to have a constructive dialogue. And to be fair, we have had that with them. And that's what is really important, that we are examined. This is an open process. It's evidence-based. And we need to put forward and present and justify those proposals, and that's done in an open forum. And if that requires quite a few people to do that, then that's what we should do.
The suggestion that's being made is that the look of this this wind farm is going to effectively put tourists off. It'll destroy the enjoyment of the properties to hundreds of people along the, probably thousands along the northeast coast of the island. Again, is that something you can maybe understand the position that's being taken there?
Absolutely. Of course, it's a big change. If this project goes ahead, it will have it will deliver a big change to the view out to sea. We know that. Of course, you can already see wind turbines from the beach that are over on the English side of the line, and I think we're in no way trying to suggest that this won't have impacts. And of course, the whole examination process is to consider all of these different aspects. That's why it's so important, as Jamie's just said, for people to express their views through writing to the examiners and all the other means by which people can raise those concerns. But we absolutely don't dismiss those concerns. They're completely valid. And again, I would say we would like to talk, you know, walk through the visualizations that we've done. We've seen some that are going around that are perhaps not as true a representation. We've done a lot of work using standard and recognized approaches that the examiners and others accept to understand what it looks like. But they are going to be visible, these turbines, and we have to engage people and understand how those concerns play out for each of them. As regards to tourism, I think the jury's out a little bit. We have seen where we've built wind farms in other parts of the world, including in the UK, that tourism in the areas where there is active tourism hasn't been particularly impacted. Of course, I can't speak for exactly what the outcome would be if we were able to build this project, but I don't think one can assume that building this wind farm would mark the end of the tourist industry by any stretch.
The difference, though, of course, is that the turbines that you're building are between 6 and 12 miles. The turbines that are already there are 12 miles and more away. This is going to be much more visible than the turbines that we can currently see from the off the east coast of the island.
Absolutely true, Phil. These are closer to the beach than the ones that are that you can currently see. I think the big difference, though, is these turbines, this wind farm, would come with significant benefits for everyone on the island. And I'm happy for Jamie and me to kind of unpack that for you and for your listeners. And we shouldn't forget that is a major part of what this project brings. And we know it has an impact on the seascape, of course, and that these turbines being closer to the shore than the ones just across that 12 nautical mile line, they will be more visible. It's very much a personal thing. Not surprisingly, I'm quite content looking at wind turbines, and we have heard others who've had gone through this and have seen wind farms put up within their view. There is a mix of views. Some people say, no, I still don't like them. But plenty of other people are saying, actually, now they're there, I'm okay with it. And I think if we combine that with all of the points around what this can bring economically to the island, we feel it's a great opportunity. But ultimately, it will be for the islanders to decide the future of this project. Obviously, we're advocates, but it's not our decision, and nor should it be.
And what can you do to disguise the turbines to make them less visible?
Well, I wonder if Jamie, I'm going to pass to you on this one, actually, because I think you're working on the whole visual impact and how that can be best mitigated. So perhaps want to pick up with Jamie.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, I think there's a couple of things I'd like to say. One is that obviously the Manx territorial waters only go out to 12 nautical miles, so 22 kilometres, and therefore for it to be of a benefit, and primarily an economic benefit to the island, it needs to obviously be within those waters. We recently saw just the other side of the 12 nautical mile boundary, another offshore wind farm, similar kind of size in terms of number of turbines and dimensions, which was known as the Morgan project, that received consent, and the island wouldn't receive, if that goes ahead, they won't receive any, there'll be no direct benefit, and yet that will be on that 12 nautical mile, which is where we extend out to. At the moment, we're at 6 nautical miles to 12 nautical miles, and that will be examined, as it should be. We expect in May, when we have the next set of hearings, to get into the seascape and landscape visual impact. So we're open to considering what we can do about that. Clearly, it's quite difficult on a lovely clear day like today to disguise the turbines. We do have some options, particularly around kind of nighttime views, because we do have to have lighting for safety, for navigation, for aviation. And we are looking with potentially having what's called aviation detection lighting systems. So the lighting on top of the kind of nacelle, which is the middle part of the rotor, to have it so it's only activated when we've got aircraft at a certain height coming over. That's obviously an expense to us, but we recognise that that's, you know, it is important. We can understand, and we've shown this, let's be clear, we've shown this in our photo montages that are made public. You can view them on our website, you can view them on the MEMA website. We're not trying to hide that you will be able to see them under good, clear conditions. But there are things we can do around that. I had a conversation a month or so ago with Howard Parkin about this and the impact potentially on dark skies. We're very aware of that. We will do as much as we can to reduce that visual impact the viewer's interpretation of that. But clearly, in the daytime, nice views across the East Coast, yes, you will be able to see them there on the horizon, and they will be closer than the ones you can see. But also the island will be benefited. That is going to happen around the UK and potentially around on the Irish coast as well, just outside the Manx waters. It is something that is happening, and we feel, as I say, we've been invited by the government, we should at least put on the table proposals where the island can benefit from that. And that's what we're doing. Ultimately, it's not our decision. It is for ultimately the Council of Ministers and the examiners to make a recommendation. We've been really clear in our assessment as well. We've said there is a major significant change and impact from visual impact. We're not trying to hide anything here. We want to have an open debate and say, this is what we've concluded. What can we do to mitigate it? What's possible? We will look to commit to that where we've still got a viable business case to we don't want to get a consent if we can't build it, we just wouldn't. So that's what we're doing, and I think that will be examined next month in the hearings. And I again invite people, I'm sure we will have lots of people coming to that and making their views, and we will listen and we will do what we can and try and reduce that impact, because we recognise that is one of probably the most significant, particularly for those communities in the northeast coast.
One thing you can do, of course, is reduce the size of the turbines. I mean, the suggestion on the programme a few weeks ago was that these are bigger than the turbines that we can currently see that have already been developed. Is that the case? And why, if that is the case, have you chosen the larger turbines?
We haven't chosen any turbines, let's be clear. These are big projects. What we have is what's called a maximum design envelope. So we have a maximum number of turbines and we have a maximum tip height and rotor diameter. And because should this project get consent and go ahead, we're talking about probably around 2030 when we're really getting serious about starting construction, and that would be the time we would be looking to, I guess, procure the turbines. We don't exactly know where the turbine technology will be there. At the moment, we've got a project on the East Coast, Hornsea 3, that's been constructed now. We're using what's called 15 megawatt turbines, roughly around 270, 280 meter tip height, and just about 180 metres, I think, to kind of hub height, maybe a bit less than that. That's where we are currently with the technology. What we've seen over the last 10, 15 years is an increase in turbine size. They've become more efficient. We can get more generation out of them for less turbines. So we are working to provide as much a bit of flexibility to see where we can go. If we were to build these today, they would be around the 270, 280 mark. And possibly we will still be at that place in 4 or 5 years' time. But we may not be. And it is the turbine manufacturers who will be the ones but we will have to some extent work with on that. So there is a good chance we'll be less than 300 metres. It's still very high. It's still going to be a big impact. And equally, if we've got smaller turbines, we probably would have those kind of 87 turbines. If we've got bigger turbines, we would look to have less turbines because we've got a grid connection that's fixed at the moment, and so we need to work within those parameters. So nothing's fixed, and we'll go through that examination, and those will be the type of questions which I'm sure we all get questions on. Is it better to have more turbines but slightly smaller? Is it better to have less turbines but slightly bigger? The envelope we've got at the moment encompasses both, so it is a kind of worst case scenario that we've put forward, and that's the way in which these assessments are done, to base it on a worst case scenario.
The other thing, before we move on to the benefits, which we are going to do, don't worry about that, well, two areas that are of concern to the island residents. Firstly is the fishing industry, secondly is the marine environment. How big an impact is this likely to have on the Manx fishing industry?
I mean, it will be a change. I think what we've seen, again, from the projects we've developed and built in the UK and all around the world, is that fishing, there is disruption during construction. It's a relatively short period. We've usually would put in the foundations over the course of a kind of a year or in the summer months of the year, and then turbines, we'd be putting those up a year later. That's typically what happens, and there is disruption during those times. Following that, for the operational period, what we found is that fishers do continue to fish in the array. If anything, what it does is it impacts the kind of really big trawlers. They won't go into kind of an array, but certainly the smaller fishers, we see it across the UK, and Benj probably knows more than I do about that. But fishers can and they do fish in arrays. And in some cases, actually, it can benefit fish populations because it is keeping those kind of big trawlers out. I don't know if we get that here in the Manx waters quite as much, but we certainly do in the North Sea. And also we're creating kind of vertical stacks with the foundations, which actually can be quite beneficial for marine life and shellfish. Having said that, clearly there are concerns from the fishing. We've got a good open dialogue with David Beard at the Manx Fish Producers Organisation. We've got a number of meetings set up. We've had a few, and I do think we're getting somewhere to ensure that we can support the fishing industry to make sure it's safe and to make sure that they can continue to fish productively should the project go ahead. And we're quite confident we can achieve that and we are discussing that with both MFPO and also DEFA.
So you're the fishing expert then?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a fishing expert, especially as some of your listeners are actually out there fishing. Just to build on what Jamie said, though, we have seen from, if I pick out one of our wind farms, Westernmost Rough off the east coast of England, actually, I think it might be closer to shore than what we're proposing here, certainly similar distance. We work really closely with the Holderness Fishing Industries Group to agree how we would work together during construction. And now we collaborate very well with the fishing community. They come in, they do their fishing, we coordinate with them. And we've run studies, and actually they've been published in a peer-reviewed journal, looking at what has been the impact on catch as a result of the wind farm. And there was a short-term increase in catch, actually, after we'd built it, and now it's very much where it was before. So there's no indication that there's any detrimental impact on the on the level of catch. Obviously, each area is different, but there are also studies in Scotland looking at trawling take in and around some of the Scottish offshore wind farms with similar results. So I think we can be reasonably confident that this isn't going to cause a loss of fishing. I think the important thing, as Jamie said, is that we find the right way to work with the fishing community whilst we're constructing, because at that point we do have, for safety reasons, to close the area to other vessel traffic because there's some very big operations going on during those construction works. I'm confident, as Jamie is, that we can find a way through together to make this work, and we can coexist successfully, as we've seen on all 12 of our wind farms in England.
The area particularly that is of interest to you, of course, is also the area that's of interest to the herring. They love spawning on relatively shallow gravel banks, which is one of the reasons this area was chosen, is because it's in the shallower end of the of our territorial sea. How do you avoid causing too much damage to the herring spawning?
So herring spawning is a vital part of the maintenance of fish stocks. We absolutely see that. And as you say, herring tend to spawn on banks, and we tend to build wind farms on banks. So this is certainly not the first time that we've found ourselves interacting with herring spawning. And I'll just say a few words, but I think it's good for Jamie maybe to jump in with some more details. There are things that we can do, and we will do, to mitigate the impact, because we know we need to protect those herring spawning activities during construction. I think during operation, that's not going to be an issue. And as I say, we have dealt with this in the past, and the examination process will very much be looking into this as well as many other things. But maybe, Jamie, you'd want to say a bit more about how herring spawning can be dealt with, things like how we manage piling of the foundations into the seabed, for example. We're looking at all kinds of different novel technologies and proven technologies that we can use and continue to develop to minimise the impact, because we do recognise that herring spawning is a vital part of the biosphere here.
I think I'm no expert on fish ecology, but I think certainly in herring spawning, my experience actually working on a previous project, for instance, we had a restriction on when we could do some of the piling, and that was, I think, a kind of six-week period where we had kind of limited piling activities. So they're the types of things that we would expect to discuss with the examiners, and if required, we would have what's called a condition to any consent that means we would have to comply with potentially restricting piling during kind of sensitive herring spawning. I think it tends to be kind of late summer, from what I understand, for herring in particular. And similarly, with piling, it's obviously piling the foundations is it's proper construction. You are kind of hammering in monopiles into the seabed, and there is lots of potential impacts to things like benthic ecology, to marine mammals. What we and every other kind of serious developer around the world is we have to ensure that we're meeting environmental protection thresholds there. And there are, as Ben just alluded to, there's a number of ways you can do that. And we're one of those technologies we're looking at the moment is to create kind of low noise piling, where you kind of this thing called Osonic, which is we've been pioneering on. There's other technologies which are more established, which we've used in the past, things called double bubble curtains, which basically provide a kind of noise barrier, certainly helpful with any marine mammals. And we have procedures such as things called soft start, where you're essentially for a couple of hours you're tapping in the kind of monopile, if that's what we're using, and it allows time for any marine mammals or cetaceans to kind of disperse and get away and move away from the area. So they're just three or four examples of the things that we would expect to do as part of this to protect the environment, and that is the job of the examiners, to hold us to account and for us to work with stakeholders to say, look, we've done our assessment, what do you think we need to do, and then to it, and you know, some of this costs a lot of money, and some of this we might argue against, say, look, this is a pretty negligible impact, could be a conclusion, or for whatever reason. But ultimately, it's not our decision. If we get landed with, you know, quite restrictive conditions, then we have to comply with those. We have to demonstrate that we can deliver this wind farm in a sustainable way. It's part of Ørsted's kind of outlook on this, and we have to do it like that. It's not a question of choice. We might challenge certain things. So that, obviously, this is the first time we've done this on the island, but we have done this a lot over in the UK, and these are some of the challenges that we are, you know, we rightly being questioned on, and we will, you know, work with the examiners and stakeholders to make sure we get the best, most optimum kind of way to mitigate any potential impacts.
And finally, before we do move on to the benefits, the piling, I mean, how audible is that going to be for residents living along the northeast coast of the Isle of Man?
Yes, good question. I suspect, again, this will come up in the kind of May hearings. Again, unmitigated, there is the potential for airborne noise. We're still 6 nautical miles, around 11 kilometres at the nearest point. It partly depends on whether we're doing kind of what's called concurrent piling, where you're piling two locations at the same time. So, and also depends on kind of weather conditions in terms of if it's calm or if the wind is blowing in certain directions. But again, it's a bit like the marine mammals point. There's thresholds that we need to meet, and that's pretty clear, and we will meet them, and we will have to alter our piling arrangement. So maybe we're not piling under certain weather conditions, or not piling two piles together, or not piling at night time, which is more sensitive, for instance, than daytime from a noise perspective. And we'll have to demonstrate that we can do that. This is why these protections kind of exist. So I'm not saying you're never going to hear some piling noise in the daytime when it's particularly kind of quiet, but I think we will certainly have to ensure that that is reduced to an acceptable level, and we will have to be confident on that, and we will have to demonstrate that confidence, and the examiners will have to be confident that we can secure that as part of any consent.
Douglas City Council have come out in favour of the wind farm, and one of the reasons that they have given is because some of the electricity is coming back to the Isle of Man. Is that the case?
We're still looking at a couple of options, and I'm going to defer to Jamie to set them out in a bit more detail. But yes, absolutely. This wind farm, if we get to build it, will generate a large multiple of the island's total energy consumption, both now and what's envisaged in the future. So a lot of this power is going to go into the GB grid through a connection over to the west coast of England. But we are looking at options on how we can bring power to the island, and particularly meet some of the island's and the government's objectives around clean power, around decarbonisation, and delivering energy security. So we absolutely recognise this is an important aspect of what this project is expected to bring to the island. I'll let Jamie just unpack in a little bit more detail the two options that we're currently working on with the government.
Yeah, so we've outlined kind of two options: a direct connection back to the island from the wind farm. We refer to it as the island link, and that would be looking to build one, possibly two cables that we would bring in landfill, probably around Groundle Bay, and then work with Manx Utilities to connect that to the grid. So that was, there's quite a lot of emphasis and discussion about that in the first set of hearings in March. So that's one option, and we've committed that we can do that. And I want to be really clear: there isn't a requirement for us to do that. We voluntarily said, look, you know, we want to give that option to the island. Should the island wish to go down that and get a direct connection back to the island to essentially to cover the island's current energy demand.
And presumably, there's a bit of kind of negotiation through the process going on here with the MUA, because clearly the MUA will want you to do as much as possible, and you will want the MUA to do some of the bear some of the cost as well. So at the moment, once the electricity arrives at Groudle, it's then for the MUA to connect in, which is going to be quite a big process.
I want to be really clear. We commit to cover the cost, the full cost, to connect it back to the onshore connection. So there is no cost to Manx Utilities or the taxpayer. There has to be some kind of guardrails around that. It's not an open checkbook. But we do require, for those onshore connection works, Manx Utilities to clearly be involved. The regulations that we have submitted the wind farm on only allow us to go what's called 250 metres onshore with our connection. We a separate application for the onshore works is required. So when we will, if the island chooses to go down that route, we will pay for that connection to the essentially to an onshore substation, probably close to Pool Rose. But yes, we do need, there is a separate application, a town and country planning application, that would be required for the for those onshore works, which Manx Utilities do anyway on the island. The second option is, if the island isn't particularly interested in necessarily getting electricity direct from the wind farm, then as Ben just said, we can take all of that electricity back to the UK, and then seek to agree a deal with the island to bring back some of that electricity through the Manx One interconnector at a cheaper than wholesale electricity rate. Now, we need to work with not just Manx Utility, but the government more generally on those options. We are doing that now. We would like, ideally, to get a bit of clarity on a preference around that. But also, we want to be really clear. We don't want to dictate to the island what they should or shouldn't do. We want to give, that needs to be a choice of the island. So we're trying to provide those two options. And ultimately, it'll be up for the island and the government to decide which works best.
One of the suggestions, I think, that I, or the interpretations perhaps that I put on the programme from a few weeks ago when we heard from the objectors, was that they may be persuaded about the national interest if it was more than £2 billion over 35 years. It doesn't sound like an awful lot, considering the scale of the wind farm. I mean, is that figure, first of all, correct? And am I right in thinking £2 billion doesn't sound like an awful lot of money over 35 years?
I think that figure of £2 billion is probably quite conservative, actually. And there are a lot of variables that aren't determined yet, not least how big is this wind farm going to be if we get to build it. And Jamie's already touched on some of the considerations during the examination process around what the size and capacity and output of that wind farm would ultimately be. But I do think the £2 billion is a conservative number. I think as well, looking back over the brochure that we've put out, I think we can probably do more to explain what this really would mean for people on the island. What does this amount of money year in, year out? And it would start from the day when we start generating, so there will be no delay. These monies will come in straight away. I do think we've got some work to do to properly explain what that amount of money does for the island. You know, as I said earlier, I do think this is, from my perspective, an opportunity to take this wind farm, obviously with the visual impacts and other impacts that we've already discussed, but to get those benefits. I wouldn't turn my nose up at over £2 billion of benefit. I do think it's a material, it's a chunky piece of revenue for islanders to see invested in public services and whatever else they choose to ask for of their politicians.
If we could break that down, I mean, is the $2 billion, is that just for renting the seabed, and then there's the new tax that was introduced by Alex Allenson last year, or is the $2 billion the tax and the rental, seabed rental?
Yeah, so that figure of at least $2 billion is based on a combination of rental payments that we'd pay whilst we're generating and then the taxes that we would pay. You'll be aware that on top of that, there are some other investments that we're bringing, if you like the Community Investment Fund, £22.5 million there. And there are other benefits, jobs and others. But that $2 billion is principally based on those two elements, the rental and the tax.
Again, $22 million. I'm not saying that it's not a wonderful thing, but $22 million over 35 years is less than $1 million a year. And when you look at the concerns that the residents have, they might be expecting a little bit more than that.
I think it's over 15 years. Is that right, Jamie?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we think that's, I think if you go and look at, well, what can you do with that? I think it gets you a lot, actually, across the island, across various areas of interest, whether that's community groups, environmental groups and others. But Jamie, I don't know if you want to comment on where that figure comes from. Certainly in comparison to what we see other wind farm developers doing and what we do elsewhere, I think it's certainly at the upper end of what we've seen being useful to deploy into the community.
Yeah, I think I'll just mention a couple of things. The Community Investment Fund is £1.5 million for the first 15 years.
So that's £1.5 million a year.
Yeah, and I think that's roughly about comparable to kind of national lottery funding on the island, as I understand. So that's quite significant, and we don't want to set out what that's used for. I think that is up for the island, but there's quite a lot of stuff you could do with that, and then I think the $2 billion, and as Ben just said, is at the moment it's probably slightly conservative from our modelling. It will depend on the size of the eventual wind farm should we get consent and build out. The seabed rental is based on a kind of generation percentage, and so if it's a smaller wind farm, that will be slightly less. That's 55, 60 million pounds a year for 35 years, and I think if you compare what you could do with that money or what the government could do, I mean, you know, it compares with things like, you know, the healthcare bill, and I think some of the other things that I've heard and around that. So it is a significant chunk of money every year for 35 years. And I think it's, again, just to compare that with, clearly it needs to be with Manx Waters to get that economic benefit. But as I said earlier, there is a consented wind farm at 12 nautical miles for which the Isle of Man will receive no direct benefit. I think it needs to be contextualised like that. I again agree, I think, with Benj that $2 billion to an island size of the Isle of Man is going to go, should be a substantial benefit. I mean, it is, we worked it out, it's about 3-4% of total government revenue from a single project. So I do think it's seen, and I do think within government it is seen as an economic opportunity, and the policy that we are working to does recognise that, the government policy, that is.
And in terms of jobs, what benefit is there? Because presumably you'll have your experts and they'll be based in the UK. So what employment opportunities are there in the island?
I'll come to that. I just kind of want to emphasise this $2 billion plus figure. I think the other bit of important context, of course, is that all of the capital, all of the money that's invested to enable that $2 billion of income to come to the island is all with Orsted. The islanders, the taxpayers of the Isle of Man, won't have to contribute anything to that. So it is, I think it's important to see it in the context of, it's not an investment, it is a decision. It's perhaps an investment of visual amenity and other things, but it does come out of the Orsted funding. So I think that's an important point. In terms of employment, I think we've already made clear that we're committed to running our operations out of the Isle of Man. Jamie, I don't know if we've selected a port yet. It's probably a bit early for that. But we do see, I think it's around 30 direct jobs. For example, all the technicians that will keep these turbines running and do all of the offshore work, plus all of the onshore work around the warehousing and all the rest. Plus, of course, what we've seen where we have operations is there are a lot of knock-on benefits in terms of the very local supply chains that support that work. And these are good jobs. These are long-term jobs. As we've already said, the wind farm's going to be operating for 35 years if it's built. So these are careers, not just passing jobs. And they're in an industry that enables those skills to be taken wherever people choose to take them around the world. We're seeing these jobs appearing right across the globe. And they're well paid as well. So we think that's an important part of what we bring. And I for one, am really excited about the opportunity to provide jobs for some of the perhaps younger people on the island. I know there's always questions over what are the job opportunities, how do you build a career as someone who's coming out of education on the island. And I think this is one exciting opportunity that we'd love to add to the portfolio of things that are there.
The other thing, of course, that comes at a cost to Ørsted is presumably there's going to have to be some form of bond for decommissioning, assuming that after 35 years you don't say, well, actually, we've still got the permission, so we'll recommission the wind farm.
That's right. We it's anyone's guess where we'll be in 35 years. The engineering suggests that these turbines and all the associated equipment will certainly last out to that 35-year period. We know that we will be committing to the decommissioning. That's absolutely standard wherever we build wind farms in the world, actually. That is on us to deliver, and we have to put measures in place, bonds or whatever it turns out to be, to make sure that the funds are available to do that. Your question around repowering, I think, you know, there's always questions about, should we keep this wind farm running for longer now it's here? Should we, you know, who knows how the islanders feel about the project if we build it and it's there for a third of a century? Maybe people say, actually, we're happy with this and we'd like to see it carry on. Then there's a different conversation about potentially putting in a new set of equipment and keeping it going for longer. So that's a long way away, and I certainly won't be around to be in those discussions.
I suppose the final question, how long is this going to take to go from final decision, assuming the decision is a positive one for Ørsted, how long before we'll actually see the power?
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Yeah, obviously it's these are big infrastructure projects. They take time. We're hoping that we'll get a decision either way. We would have liked it by the end of this year, but I suspect we might be into beginning of next year on the timescale. Should that be a kind of consent, then we would then look to the transmission side to start developing the connection back to the UK, but also to look to essentially secure the finance revenue to support the project. So that's the other big area that we would need to do to have a viable project. It's not just the consent. It needs to stack up, and we haven't talked about it, and I'm don't intend to go into it, but the contract for difference auction in the UK is the mechanism which we and the Isle of Man government, in connection with the UK, has identified. And we're quite confident that we'll be able to kind of get eligibility for that market. If that all goes well, then I think we'd be looking to start kind of getting procurement towards the end of this decade and starting construction beginning of the 2030s. I think in terms of how long it'll take to actually then build out, usually you do the onshore connection works first, and the last couple of years, as I alluded to earlier, is really for foundations and then the turbine. So I think we're looking at the middle of the 2030s before we're fully operational. Obviously some turbines may well be on stream a little bit earlier before, but typically they come on in a kind of across a year, and as soon as they're up, they're generating something. So yeah, that's the broad time scales, but we've got a long way to go before, and the first one is obviously the consent, and we recognise it's a difficult decision, and we recognise that, and we understand that it's a big change potentially, and as I say, it's not our decision, it will be for the island to decide. And I would just like to say again, we're really open to talking to people. We don't always have to agree, but it is important we keep it to the debate to facts as much as possible and present those, and let's see where we are in 12 months time.
So what do you think? If permission is granted, the wind farm will be much more visible than other wind farms off our east coast. But is this intrusion a price worth paying for more stable energy prices and a cleaner environment? I'm Phil Gorn, Gurumhausen Geishakrom. Thanks for listening.